Welcome to Crossroads and Cauldrons. We are two witches with jobs, families, and busy lives just like you. We talk about weaving the web of community, practicing magic, and life in the Deep South. Hello everyone, welcome to the show. I'm Selena and you're listening to Crossroads and Cauldrons podcast. I have such an exciting guest for you today, and we actually had to reschedule the recording date for this episode. So I have been just kind of waiting impatiently for this interview to happen. So I'm very excited to announce our guest today is Terrence Ward. He's the author of Empty Cauldrons. He is a journalist, priest, and editor who practices a combination of Hellenic polytheism and Quakerism in the Hudson Valley, of New York State. Words, man, words are hard. Welcome to the show, Terrence. I'm so happy you're here.
Well, thank you for having me. I've been really looking forward to this too.
Yay! I just have to say, I'm so happy that you wrote this book. Marcus at Llewellyn sent me a box of books, and you know, I'm looking through it, and I saw this one, and I was like, yes. This is a conversation we need to be having, and I don't think we're having enough of this conversation. So your book is Empty Cauldrons: Navigating Depression Through Magic and Ritual. So I'm thrilled that you wrote this book. This is a vital conversation to have, particularly within spiritual communities. So let's talk about that. I think there's so many dangerous ideas in dealing with depression within spiritual communities. You know, there's lots of spiritual bypassing, and I think it's particularly important to sort of examine these ideas also from a pagan perspective, which is a little bit hard to come by as well when dealing with and sort of navigating depression. So what sort of inspired you to write this book?
Well, honestly, Selena, I think the reason why we don't have these conversations is because when you are experiencing something like depression, that is the bottom of your list is to talk about. And it was actually my editor, Heather Green at Llewellyn, who encouraged me to seriously consider writing this as a book, because I'd explored it through some journalism and posts on my blog about the ideas of depression, because when you're not in depression, you're more okay with talking about it. And through that encouragement, we came to the agreement that you're right, it is an important thing to write about, and that I would be willing to do it. And let me tell you, I learned way more than I thought I would by writing this book. I thought I knew what I was talking about when I started, but I really didn't.
Isn't that always the way? It's always the way I experience things too. I'm like, oh, here's a brilliant idea. Let me do it. Oh, I know nothing. I have to research for 1,000 years now. I'm glad that she encouraged you to do that. I think the first part of the book is really focused on sort of dissecting and defining what depression is. And I think that exploring it from a pagan perspective, like I know that, in my work in pastoral care and things like that, these situations come up and we don't always have the tools to deal with those. And when I say we don't always, very rarely, unless you're also a counselor or unless whatever tradition or you know, background you come from has given you some training in helping support people, or if you've experienced it yourself, you don't really have the tools to help people. And on the side of spiritual bypassing, it's so easy to fall into that trap that a lot of people I know ran from. You know, you're not praying hard enough. You're not believing hard enough. You know, these are very, very dangerous traps. How do you, when you were examining what depression is, I really want to look at that. I want to look at that because one of the sort of classic techniques in dealing with depression or anxiety in like a clinical setting is in giving it a name, you know, in naming whatever it is. But I think they're looking at that from a psychological standpoint, like a trick of the mind. But for pagans, especially if you come from an animist perspective, that's not a trick of the mind. That's recognizing a living consciousness, right? Recognizing that recognizing depression as a spirit. Tell me a little bit about that, because that whole naming process has roots in shamanic healing practices. You know, so how do you find that helpful in working, particularly with pagans, which is mostly who listens to my show, but in general as well? How do you find that sort of animist perspective of connecting with depression as a spirit to be helpful and harmful? Let's talk about it.
Well, many of the people that I interviewed for my book had a similar experience to mine in that they described depression as in part being a voice in your head. Mm-hmm. And it's a voice that's saying things that aren't complimentary, that aren't constructive, that are in fact quite counterproductive in a lot of cases. You know, you don't want to go out. You don't want to interact with people. Those people don't like you anyway. You're too fat or too old or you laugh too much and you should probably stay home because they're just too polite to say so. Mm-hmm. And everything about this voice is encouraging the worst. You'll have it stoke the flames of anger so that you blow your top and push away the few people that you are willing to spend time with because it really wants you all to itself. Mm-hmm. And it's that idea of there being a voice in your head that made me realize over time that this really is a spirit. If this is, whether that spirit is born from our own personality or it moved in from afar, it has its own motives and its own desires. And being able to recognize that it has different motivations and that it's not you is incredibly helpful. I go so far in the book as to create a ritual construct where you can physically move your depression into a totem on a depression shrine. So you can actually have a conversation with it and maybe try to find ways to satisfy it that don't involve you not showering for 3 months. Mm-hmm. It just gives it so much more perspective to be able to talk about it rather than just saying, I'm the problem. The mm-hmm. problem is really just the relationship you have with depression. I'm not even sure that depression itself is a problem because there is some interesting research suggesting that it has an evolutionary role, much like the appendix had an evolutionary role, and that it probably means well. It might not fit in with the 21st century lifestyle, or maybe it's a serious warning that there's something really broken in the 21st century lifestyle that is trying to pull us away from. Either way, it's an awful process, and whether it's there to cause harm or not, it is causing harm, and we need to be able to have that conversation as the beginning of finding a way to live in some kind of harmony at the very least.
I think it's important too. I really liked the idea of literally creating a shrine for it and setting up a construct for it, because then you're sort of removing it from yourself in a way and giving yourself that perspective. Because a lot of times that voice, at least I'll speak from my own experience, but a lot of times that voice sounds like your own voice, you know, and you start to believe the things that it's saying to you. You know, I still do that. I still, like, even when I'm wanting to reach out to people for the podcast, I'm like, no, they're going to say no, they don't like me. I shouldn't do that. You know, I still do that. You know, and it's, I have to recognize, okay, that's this voice. That's not me saying that. You know, that's not really true. The evidence doesn't point to that being the case because nobody's turned me down yet. So, you know, but it helps so much to build a relationship, like you said, to recognize it as an entity that you can communicate with, that you can have relationship with. And I think that could probably be problematic if people are feeling like, why is this entity here? Why is this chosen me? Why is this aspect of consciousness communicating with me? And I think some of that has to do with our sensitivity and perception, you know, that we're deeply feeling people. And I think everybody has the capacity to be deeply feeling people, of course. But, you know, we got a lot of it. Like, I'm trying to think right now about how many students I've had that have not had some sort of run-in with depression at some point in their lives. I'm coming up real dry here. I got nothing.
You know, that's an interesting point you make. When I was giving thought to who I would want to interview. It's funny. Not every person I asked wanted to talk to me, but every person I asked had something to say. And I didn't know that a lot of the people I asked were mostly, I think, were people that I thought knew a lot of people and might have a perspective. Most of them have a direct perspective. And that really kind of made me take a step back, because it is not difficult to find someone who's familiar with depression.
Yeah, it really isn't. It really isn't. I was honestly surprised and sort of relieved in a way when I was reading through the book, because there are people, you know, that you interviewed that I wouldn't have expected. And you know, that's depression talk. You know, it's just you. You're the unworthy one, right? And I'm looking at these people that I consider deeply successful and that I look up to and respect, and they're dealing with the same stuff. You know, so I think that's part of why it's so important to have these conversations, because it is isolating, as you mentioned, very isolating. So one of the things we were talking about, pagans in particular, do you feel that pagans are particularly empowered to when working with depression? Because we already have these concepts of recognizing cycles, which is a big part. Recognizing this is now, but it's going to end. You know, I'm going through a phase of depression. And also, like we talked about before, recognizing depression as a living consciousness that you can partner with. And also sort of the power of ritual and introspection that we do as part of our spiritual practice. Do you think that gives pagans an advantage in working through depression?
I agree that we have many tools that might not be available to a lot of other people. However, if you aren't aware of what's going on, you can become blind to all the tools you have. Especially if you allow yourself to become isolated, you can, with that voice in your head, become easily convinced that you don't have any tools and that you don't have any power. That's why one of the things that I think is essential to help us all is to embrace community, is to find ways to be with others that understand us. Even people that we don't know very well are better than being alone all the time. Community dilutes and disempowers depression. And I think that there's really no downside to it, which is why the more depressed you are, the more uncomfortable you get with the notion. One of the rules of thumb I find about depression is that anything you really don't want to do is probably exactly what you need to do.
Yep, you need to play opposite day. I would agree with
that. It just needs to be opposite day all the time.
Mm-hmm. Just be contrary back with it. That is extremely helpful, though, too, because that's really some of the first signs you get when you're in it. For myself, I will speak for myself. When I'm in it, that's the first thing I notice, is that I just feel unmotivated. And I'm a person who's constantly going and doing and filling every minute of my day, which is a different problem. but when I'm just not, I don't want to do anything, I'm not excited about anything, I'm just, no, that's the first part that I noticed. There are signs before that I've learned to start to see before it gets to that point, but it took years and years and years to recognize those. So that's exactly what I do. And I find it helpful is to just say, oh no, I'm going to drag myself up and do this one thing. And it does help. And it feels like the hardest thing in the entire world. You know, I'm going to water the plants, you know, I'm going to go pick up a book off the shelf and just hold it in my lap for a while. Maybe I'll open it later. You know, it's hard. It feels like you're walking underneath a mountain, you know, to be able to get yourself moving, to do that thing, that one little thing.
It's one of the things that is a challenge for pagans is that your relationships with non-corporeal entities is very fragile at that time. I find that having plants to water and pets to feed is more helpful in the depths of depression, because all of your senses will acknowledge that this is going on. And you have that corporeal obligation. It's easier to ignore a spirit or a god when if they aren't manifesting physically when you're in depression. And frankly, you're probably going to say they didn't want me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or they, this must not be real. I've been making it all up, and you start to not trust your own experiences. I've had sort of blackout periods where I completely felt disconnected from my power, from my guides, from everything. It was just like this deafening silence, and it was terrifying. You know, for me, the only way to get through it was to keep going through the motions, and eventually something clicked. Of course, I was doing a lot of shadow work at that time, which feels the same. But I finally, something clicked, and it was part of that. It was part of recognizing, wait a minute, this is depression. And sometimes just naming it and seeing it kind of unlocks that hold that it has on you in that moment, you know? But as we were, that was my very next question was like, how is it particularly difficult? What are our disadvantages as pagans when dealing with depression? And I think some of that is we do take responsibility. You know, there's not like, generally speaking, there's not a devil who's coming to get us and mess up our lives. You know, we take responsibility for the things in our lives, which can lead to us feeling overly responsible for our own depression, you know, or feeling disempowered, you know, feeling disconnected from our deity. And we also have probably more than, I'm not going to say more than most, but it definitely is a thing. We have a lack of community support for many of us. You know, there's more of us practicing solitary than within community, I would probably say, at least in the South. And we're already isolated in that way. You know, we also have issues with finding like-minded therapists. You know, I have a list that I give people, and people will come to me and say, hey, do you know any therapists that are not going to say the reason I'm depressed is because of Jesus is not in my life, you know, or whatever it is. What do you see as some of the disadvantages of approaching dealing with depression from a pagan perspective?
I love the way you've framed this already, Selena. The personal responsibility is one of the strengths of paganism, but yes, you're right. It makes it easier for that little voice to say, well, you shouldn't be telling the people in your coven that that's wrong. They're going to think you're tainted. You need to just figure it out. What's wrong with you? If you can't work this out on your own. Mm-hmm. And that's the same kind of motivation that can amplify anxiety about finding the right therapist and anything that involves human connection. Now, in terms of therapy in and of itself, I've lived a relatively privileged life in that way, because I live in the Northeastern United States, and I've just never personally encountered anyone quite that crazy. I've never had anyone accuse me of being a Satanist. I've never had a therapist try to baptize me. I know these things are real, but they haven't happened to me. However, I'm aware of the fact that these are challenges, and I spoke to people about that. One of the people that I spoke to for the book, Anthony Rella, is both a pagan and a counselor. And no licensed therapist should ever be taking religion into consideration in terms of how they evaluate their relationship with you. That should never come up. That doesn't mean it doesn't, because they're humans too, and that can get kind of twisted. But I got a lot of excellent information from Anthony, which is in the book, about how to evaluate them, and Keldon Mercury offered me a candle spell to help find a therapist that fits what you need to articulate that, which that was actually an unsolicited piece. That came up in our conversation, and Keldon just offered me whole cloth that spell, and I it was just such a gift, because if you have the idea that magic is important in your life, that's a tool you should remember you can use, even if you're in depression.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that I go back to, and I can't remember where it originally came from, but it came to me through my teachers, and that was that sometimes, you know, magical people need magical solutions to their problems, because that is how they are framed. You know, that's how their worldview is aligned. So when you can get in alignment with what's already important to you, you know, like that, like do a candle spell to find that good therapist. But also, I'll say from just my experience in the, you know, Southeast, and it's very much in the Bible Belt. And, you know, it is kind of cartoonish. Like, you hear about it when you're not exposed to it all the time, and it sounds bizarre, but it's just normal for us. There's a lot of passive sort of, I would call it passive aggression, that can go into that. So just because, you know, you're speaking with a therapist and they may say things that, you know, they have to toe this particular line or they'll lose their license, they can still have undercurrents of religious bias when dealing with you. So do listen to your comfort levels, but not to the point where you like find a different therapist. Not don't say, well, this one, you know, isn't working out, so obviously I'm never going to find a therapist. Therapy's bad. Like, I think that's a problem we run into. You go to one therapist and you feel like they're not understanding you or they're not connecting with what's important to you spiritually. And you just run from therapy altogether. And that's a dangerous row to hoe as well. So I really like that. Thanks, Keldon. Keldon was on the show a few weeks back. So he was wonderful to speak to. Let's see what my next question. So the second part of your book, that's a great segue. Thanks, Keldon. The second part of your book is all about strategies, different strategies for working with depression. So tell me a bit about how you approach that and what has worked really well for you and what has worked for people. I mean, you don't have to tell me the whole book because they need to buy it, but you know what I mean. To sum up.
Well, if you're a hammer, every problem is a nail. I'm a writer, and a lot of what I thought about was about writing. I give a lot of journal prompts in this book. I think that finding different ways to articulate what's going on in writing is a lot like what I suggest with the depression shrine. It's it's about externalizing. It gives you the opportunity to have the conversation, because you can have more control when you're doing that. And writing is, I think, a delightful thing, especially if you do it with a pen, because that is a wand, and you are directing energy through it. And that's why a lot of magical work that I do that has to do with writing, I really try to use a pen. There have been times when that hasn't been possible, but I think it really adds something to it. I also wrote a couple of rituals come from my Hellenic tradition, that being practices around the Greek gods. Including one that involves giving your depression over to Hecate, and another that invokes the spirits of the winds to help you with that. And I have some other different spells and rituals now. See, now I'm just drawing a blank because I'm so excited to be with you.
See, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. It happens all the time.
One of the challenges with spellcraft that you really have to get over is that when you're in depression, as you yourself earlier said, you could feel like it's not there. And it is anyway, which is kind of hard. It's like walking around with your feet numb. You can do it. Your body knows what it's doing, but you don't have the right feedback. So it's really hard to do it well. You need to be patient with yourself and allow yourself to take the extra time to go through the motions. If you have a regular practice of magic, it's going to be much easier because you can do it by rote, which you were also suggesting, I think, earlier, that's it's really important to have the kind of spiritual memory of the process, because that'll allow you to practice and work your magic even when you think it's absolutely nonsense.
That's such a great analogy, though, where you said it's like you can still walk if your feet are feeling numb. That's exactly what it is. Like, the mechanics are still happening from your ritual actions, from your gestures, from your words, from the power that you've built and the relationships that you've built with, you know, your deities and your spirits. All of that is still occult mechanics doesn't just disappear because you're not feeling it. Just your sensitivity, your perception of it is diminished because of the depression. The mechanics are still working. Do your thing, you know, do your thing more. I love that in the book, you know, And I think the way you put that is very, very helpful. And I think there's some advice out there, you know, on the interwebs that is not necessarily what I find to be helpful. So I think I've met all the parameters with that sentence. But you said, if you feel like, you know, you're, and I'm paraphrasing, if you're too overwhelmed to go to the altar today, go three times. You know, if you can't meditate for 10 minutes, meditate for an hour or whatever. And that's so true. That's so true. And it's so hard in those moments to say, I need this more. This is the thing that I need more. But people do. That's the first thing that they drop is their self-care, is their spiritual care. They don't take a shower for 3 weeks. You know, I know. But if you can get yourself into that, and sometimes it's as simple as that, put feet on floor. If you can do that, great. Walk to the shower. Great. Keep your clothes on. I don't even care. Get in there. You know, but take some kind of small step because it's going to lead to another step. And if you can remember that and you can train yourself for that when you're not in depression, which comes back to that daily practice, then when you are, your body, your muscle memory will take over. Your body will take over and take care of you. And your mind and your spirit and your heart can just be, you know? So yes, no, we're big journalers here. So I'm glad you talked about journaling. And I'm glad you talked about like physically doing it with a pen, like writing it by hand. I do rag my students about this. And I get a lot of them that would prefer, you know, digital dictation and things like that. But I do think there's something important about not only the physical act of putting your own energy into it physically, but of having, I think the most important part actually is having something tangible when you're done. I'll try to illustrate what I'm saying. So I'm an artist, and look how easily I said that. See, I'm growing. My depression was always like, no, you can't use that word. You know, you need to be certified to use that word. But the difference between doing something physical on canvas or a sculpture or something that I can touch that's tactile versus digital art, I can work three times as long on a digital painting as a traditional painting. And I don't feel the same quality of completion because I don't physically have something in my hand, you know, yeah, sure. I could print it out, but there's something about the making that feels different, activates something different when I can see the results. Because that digital file is going to disappear into my computer screen with everything else, you know. But when I have a painting that I got to deal with now, I got to put it on the wall, I got to sell it, I got to do something. There's something about it. There's something about physically doing the thing. And you talked about a little bit of that. And I like that. So thank you.
I want to lift up that wisdom about if you don't want to go to the altar, you need to go three times. That came from Courtney Weber, who is a phenomenal person. And again, I didn't actually know that Courtney had personal experience with depression. And what I got was a very generous amount of sharing, which a lot of people gave for me. And it's just incredibly grateful. This book wouldn't be possible without a lot of people opening their hearts to the world.
You know, and Courtney was one of the ones that surprised me too, because on one side I was like surprised. And on the other side, I was like, no, this makes sense, because she's hilarious and funny. People have suffered, first of all. But she's so energetic and she's so bright and she's so smart and, you know, all of those things. She's got this huge personality and I'm like, ugh. That checks out. It checks out, but it's not the people that you would think. I don't know why. I don't know. We have all sorts of misconceptions about depression, don't we?
Well, as soon as you're in depression, you're convinced, as you said, no one else has it.
Yes, that's true.
You're the broken one.
It's true. That's true. So, to our listeners, it's not just you. It's almost everyone I know, honestly. But yeah, I think that kind of goes back to what you were saying about, this may be a mechanism to recognize that something is off, that we're missing something, you know. And I think, some of the things that you covered in the book include like your food, our diet, the way that we work, you know, the way that we're sort of isolated from nature, just from our society. Do you think that, it seems like those things do have a relationship to depression or have an impact on depression. even if it's not necessarily the cause. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
That really comes back to the idea of what makes up a person. Especially in our Western society, the idea of a body and mind being separate is pretty deeply ingrained. I think, therefore, I am, is what one of my sources, Kari Turing, said was the problem. And depression, more than any other condition I've suffered, really impacts the body, the mind, and the spirit. And it impacts us in all those ways, and it can be mitigated in through all those channels. But it's all incredibly related. Absolutely. Anything we put into our body, including the air we breathe, the food we eat, any drugs we choose to take, is going to have an effect on how we think and our relationship with the subtle world as well. And when we understand that it's all packed in together, we can recognize things like the fact that, as I say in the book, emotions, as far as I can tell, really have nothing to do with the mind. They're all about the body. And this can be easily proven by just emulating what you feel like with an emotion. If I grit my teeth and I breathe fast and shallow and clench my fists, it feels the same as being angry, because it is. The emotions are a reaction maybe to our thoughts, but they also color our thoughts, because our body and our mind are the same person. It's not one in charge of the other. We need them both to survive, and the spirit as well.
See, I agree with you now. Now let's take this to hermeticism for just a minute. So please, let's do that. So I'm a hermetic occultist. So I believe that the body is part of the soul complex. It's one of the spirit bodies, you know, and they're all interconnected. So I think the beautiful thing about working with the other spirit bodies that are less tangible, and as we've mentioned, when you're in depression, you don't have as much awareness of them. You know, your senses and everything is diminished a little bit, but you still have access to the physical and the tangible. That's the beauty of it and the difficulty of it. But that particular spirit body, you always have access to. So yeah, if you can just wash it off, if you can do something there, you start to activate the other levels that it's connected to, and you start to get that energy flowing and moving again. And you always have access to this part of your spirit, this part of your soul complex, you know? And that's easy to forget. It's easy to forget when you're in that place. What are your thoughts about that?
I think I need to learn more about hermeticism, because that does speak to my condition. I didn't have that language to describe it in my book, or maybe the book would have been another 100 pages.
Well, good. Maybe there's room for another one. But yeah, like when you're talking about energy bodies and you're talking about spirit bodies or your soul, I think that we are all we're connected to all of those things. So yeah, that very much rings true with what I've experienced and what I believe as well. And yeah, you were mentioning some of the rituals that you did. Your Depnon for depression. I loved that. I love that very much. I work with Hecate, so I was like, yes, yes. So do check out the book and read the rituals and everything in the back, because there's so much you can work with. And it really applies to a lot more than, I know the whole focus of the book is navigating depression, but if you have anxiety or panic disorders or anything like that too, these are helpful for those things too. From my experience, those techniques help for a lot of things. And usually, I don't know, I say usually, I don't know, I haven't done any research. For me and for people that I know, depression and anxiety and other things kind of go hand in hand or feed each other as well. But I do want to talk about one thing that's a little bit taboo, shall we?
Can we talk about the taboo?
Okay, excellent. So I want this topic to not be taboo. I want people to be able to sit down and easily and casually talk about this topic and feel free to share their thoughts about it. And you dig into this a little bit in your book as well. So let's talk about suicide, shall we?
We should.
Okay. So tell me, you mentioned some different ways to work with suicidal thoughts and, you know, and for people kind of paying attention to those around them. This is such a difficult road to navigate. It's difficult because people don't talk about it. And when they do talk about it, they're surrounded by people who have no idea what to do with them and panic and freak out. So mm-hmm. that just makes them withdraw. Tell me, what are your thoughts about suicide?
Well, it terrifies almost everyone. Mm-hmm. The few people it doesn't terrify are probably the ones that are seriously giving some thought to it. And that could be a real problem.
It's terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to say right out, there are times when certain people should be able to choose to end their lives. There are circumstances and we are starting to accept those in our society. One of the challenges with depression is that it is an isolating condition, and such a big decision as ending your life cannot be made in isolation, or it's not being made well. If you're unable to talk to your loved ones about ending your own life, then you should not be ending your own life. You need to be finding a way to get intervention. Mm-hmm. This July, in the past, way back in July.
right, because this is like September now.
The suicide hotline in our country got a 3-digit code of 988. You can call 988 and you can get someone on the line who can talk to you when you're in crisis. It's that easy. It's okay to talk to someone, and those people are trained, and they're also someone you don't know, which can make it easier. Not talking to anyone is a big red flag. Mm-hmm. However, when we do talk to people who are unfamiliar with the idea, they're probably going to react in one of two ways. The first way that someone is going to react is say, oh, you're being a drama queen. Oh, you're just seeking attention. Oh, you're not serious. You should just hike up your boots and be strong and get over it. The other group of people are going to either openly or surreptitiously try to get you put into an institution where you can be cared for, because they're convinced that you're going to be making this next step within the next 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. For most people, neither of these is a good response. There's somewhere
or they
in the
make
middle.
It about themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how much they will miss you. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. If someone does approach you with these thoughts, it's okay to listen. Mm-hmm. Generally, what professionals will tell you is that if someone has a specific plan about what they're going to do to end their lives, then it is probably high time to get some professional intervention right now. Mm-hmm. But other than that, being able to just listen to them and ask open-ended questions and allow them to express their feelings is a very good first step. It might be all that a person needs right now. It might be an opportunity to talk about how to develop a relationship with a therapist or to figure out ways to change their behavior or their diet so that it is harder for depression to take hold and to be rooted in. It's not a time to be calling the mental health professionals to get an evaluation, because they're never going to talk to anyone again.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's scary too.
Being able to feel like you have somewhere you can go and just have that conversation, you know, is huge. It's huge. I have lost a lot of friends from this. I have had some friends who did not succeed, fortunately, and later regretted their decision. And I've known people that, yeah, I think it was the right choice for them in what they were going through. But I don't think they made that decision rooted in depression. You know what I mean? I think that right. The decision had other factors. And I do think people should be empowered to make those choices in a healthful way, not when they're not thinking clearly. So what can, I think there's such a stigma around suicide. And I don't know about your area, but down here, suicide is a sin. And if you do that, you're going to go to hell. And so that's the whole thing, is people don't want to talk about it because they don't want to deal with that. They don't want to deal with, you know, and unfortunately, and it's happened to just about everyone I know that has lost someone to suicide, some asshole will come up and say, you know, well, it's so sad that they're in hell now. And, you know, we can't kill them. So we just have to walk away in that moment. But it's horrible. It is horrible, the stigma around suicide, around even for just grieving families. So what can people expect when they call that suicide hotline? Like, I think a lot of people are afraid of what will happen. I think they're afraid that, you know, people will drop down on the ceiling and take them off to the loony bin. That's not what happens.
Well, for starters, I want to be clear that up here in Atheist Alley, people don't like to talk about suicide either.
And Atheist Alley, I'm writing that down.
That stigma really runs deep, and I think that a lot of people are convinced that if we talked more about suicide, people would kill themselves more often. And I think the opposite is true. When you call a mental health hotline like the suicide hotline, it is an anonymous service. They are trained to listen and to ask questions and to help you get the resources you need. They will assess through their conversation how much of a crisis you're in, whether you have a specific plan and they need to find ways to help you reconsider whether that's the right choice right now, and to help you get the support that you need in your own time and way. It is not about someone coming with a straitjacket to take you away. They aren't putting chips in your brain. This is a safe way to talk to someone. And if you call and you're scared and you hang up, you can call back. There's going to be someone there all the time. It is one of the most amazing services we have in our country.
And you can even go to their website and chat with someone as well. If you're not where you can dial a phone number and hear a voice, you can chat with them on their website.
Yeah, and that sort of distancing can make it seem less intimidating. I've noticed that it's not uncommon for people in depression to try to shunt conversations to writing, to email, or to text. It isn't always necessarily a good thing, because that means that the emotions that you are inferring from those words are all just amplifications of what's in your own head. Again, if you feel like it's the right thing to do and you're in depression, it's probably the opposite of what you should be doing. But there's some really strong motivations, and it's good that they have that text option, because it's a foot in the door. And if that's all you have the strength to do, you should do the thing.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is like, it opens a door. If your options are do nothing or type in the damn text, you know, it doesn't have to be all the way to picking up the phone and calling someone. Then you look at the next step. Do I want to call and hear a human voice that's understanding? You do call. Thank you so much for talking with me about that. It's not an easy topic for many to talk about. And I hope that it becomes that. I agree with you completely that, you know, in every situation I can think of where there's a stigma around it, talking about it, bringing awareness to it has helped people that are dealing with it versus making more people want to do it. That's crazy. Why are people like that anyway? Okay. So my next question for you, this is my favorite question to ask guests when they come on the show. What is, if you had a big thing, a big project, a big idea, something you wanted to do in the world, it doesn't have to be in the works. It doesn't have to be like fully formed in your mind. What would that be?
I have another idea for a book. And I tell you, books are big ideas.
They're huge.
I just want to take a brief tangent and say, I thought I understood what it took to write a book, and I was completely wrong.
Please tell me more about that, because I'm always saying that I'm not with the words, but I so envy that ability in others. And I try to surround myself with people that have that skill. And I'm just so deeply intimidated by it. Confirm all my fears for me, please.
Well, I write lots of articles and short things that, and I liken that to braiding or weaving, because I take the different threads and I sit with them and I find the story and I write it all at once. Mm-hmm. Books are more like quilts. They takes a lot more moving around big chunks of things and being able to hold all of that in your head at once. And that's when I write an article, I can send it off to my news editor and never think about it again. I don't actually even look at it after it's been edited because I don't care. But with a book, you have to. They force you to look at it and think about it, and they help you become a better writer. And editors are the most amazing thing. They can help people do something which is bigger than they are. I'm using they too much, but my point is, books are really big and it's a real challenge. And I'm amazed that anyone can write a book. And it's only because there are gifted editors in the world that can help walk them through it. I'm convinced of that.
I am equally amazed at authors, but I will take you, let's go back to one thing that you said. Have you done a lot of weaving in your life?
I've done some braiding and some knitting, but I haven't done weaving.
Weaving is extremely complex. So you might want to, I'm a weaver. And depending on what you're doing, it can be extremely complex. So you might want to check your analogy there.
I'll stick with braiding.
Stick with braiding. There you go. my ears perked up. I was like, weaving, let's talk about it. Oh, he doesn't know. So that's an exciting project. So what's the next book? You kind of skirted the answer there. What's the book idea? Can you talk about it?
Yeah, I don't think it's another subject that I think is mostly taboo. I don't think we really understand our relationship with money and what it does to the world and what it does to us.
That's a big idea.
Yeah.
So what perspective are you coming at that from?
Really the same one for this. Money's a spirit and our relationship with it doesn't have to be the way it is.
Excellent. I want to read that book and I want to buy one for all of my friends as well.
You see, make me money. It's perfect.
It's perfect. And that will feed you. And there we go.
The best way to make money is to write books about how to make money.
About how to make money. See, hold on a minute. This feels like a trap.
Right?
No, I'm excited about that book. And I'll just say, I mostly deal with pagans. Like that's my day job now is teaching and ministering in my community, and pagans have a shit relationship with money. Not all of them. There are plenty that are doing excellent, but just at least down here, of course, we have a lot of poverty in Mississippi as well. We don't know how to deal with money at all. And it's difficult. It's difficult to create community in that way. And it's difficult for people just to get through because you're right. Our relationship with money is fucked up. But I think that's a societal issue as well. I think it's a global
issue. You're
not wrong. I can't wait to read your book.
I think people who your relationship with money and how healthy it is, I think, is not related to how much money you happen to have.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
There's a lot of wealthy people that have a bad relationship with money, and mm-hmm. there's plenty of poor people who really are okay with where they're at and how money is in their lives. It's whether, you know, you're being drained by it, which you mm-hmm. can be, whether you have a lot or a little.
And that's the whole thing. Yeah. That's exactly the thing is, people aren't taught to have a relationship with it either. I don't know. I can't wait to read the book. I want to read the book. I want to hear your thoughts in detail about that. But for now, where can our listeners find you?
Well, since my name is easy to misspell, the best way to find me is to go to the website truepaganwarrior.com, which is easy to spell.
True Pagan Warrior. Yes, that's a good one to remember.
I have all my social media links on there, as well as a blog with fascinating posts.
I'm going to go read your blog. I'm going to read your whole blog. So I will have links to your website in our show notes. I'm also going to include links for the suicide prevention website and phone number if you would like to check that out, share it, spread it around, give a card to all your friends with that number on there. That's great. And thank you so much, Terrence, for writing this book and for coming on the show and to talking to us about depression. I appreciate that.
I really appreciate your being such an excellent host.
Stop. I'm blushing. Please come back. I can't wait. When you write your next book, I want you back on the show. So, and thank you everyone for listening. Please go check out Empty Cauldrons. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful resource. I'm glad this is going to be on my shelf the next time I am going through some depression. So please go get it, check it out, and we'll see you on the next episode. Goodbye, everybody. Blessed be. Thank you all so much for listening, and don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe through your favorite podcast provider. It helps us get our podcast in front of more listeners just like you. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can leave us a voicemail by clicking the link in the description of this episode, and you can always find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for Crossroads and Cauldrons Podcast.